the nagging. Naturalist. It's the Nagging Naturalist Podcast.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Nagging Naturalist Podcast, a podcast all about wildlife. I'm your host, Kristen, and I'm a naturalist by trade. Well, if you laugh when I say it, then one's going to believe it.
I'm sorry.
No. It's gone.
You know, you could have simply said Barry, and it just kept going, and I probably would have been able to do it, but you keep saying Kristen. And I can't. Whew. Okay.
If you want to know more about my background.
Just keep going. Go ahead. Just continue.
If you want to know more about my background, check out my first episode, What Is.
What is? It's who?
Sorry. If you want to know more about my background, check out my first episode, Who Is the Nagging Naturalist? My opinions are my own, and I do not speak for or on behalf of any organization, facility, or institute mentioned on my podcast. Insert personal update.
Oh my god, I hate you!
This month, we're covering a species found in the Australian Esperance Mallee ecoregion. I was going to say...
Oh my god, I hurt.
I was going to say ecorgion.
Oh, okay.
Today... we're discussing the dibbler.
Okay, hold on. Time out. Let me interject before you go any further. Let me actually insert that personal update.
Oh, wait. Are we including all this?
Yes.
I'm just BSing.
I know. I'm actually going to make that the intro. Congratulations. Okay, so backtracking a little bit. For anybody who listened to last week's episode, I mentioned that I might have had COVID. Well, I can say now that I do have COVID. I have been struggling for the past roughly week with symptoms that have been an absolute carousel of delights between a mild fever, cough, body aches, fatigue, congestion.
Delusions. Oh, that's what you told me one time. You're like,
I'm not sure they need to know that, though. You didn't hear from me. Yeah, I'm not going to tell my listeners I'm delusional. So, Barry's going to help me more than usual on this podcast because I am struggling a bit with everything, with being alive. So, in order to kind of take a little bit of the burden off of me during this difficult time, Barry is going to help y'all learn about the dibbler, and I may interject here and there to add some additional context and also to correct Barry's butchering of things like the Esperance Mallee ecoregion.
That's what I said.
Yeah, yeah.
Ecoregion.
Ecoregion, okay. So yes, today we're talking about the dibbler. It's sometimes called the southern dibbler because there is a northern dibbler, but it's also known as the sandstone dibbler. I'm going to spare you the taxonomy, and I'm going to do the taxonomy for you.
You sure you don't want me to read those long words that you wrote down for me?
Do you want to try them, Barry?
Kingdom Animalia.
All right.
Phylum Chordata. Uh-huh. Class Mammalia. Uh-huh. Infracrass. Infracrass. That's how I act sometimes. Infraclass. Marsupialia.
Okay.
Genus. No, I skipped a line. Order. Desuromorphia.
Well, that's pretty good.
Is that correct or is that?
That's not how I was intending to see it, but honestly, I haven't heard anybody say it out loud, so I can't prove that you're wrong. Go for it.
I would say it's either Desuromorphia or Desiromorphia. Desiromorphia. Nope, I'm getting worse. Desiromorphia. Yeah.
Family.
Family. Desuridae. includes quolls and Tasmanian devils. And genus / species is Parentechinus apicalis.
You did really, really good. I mean, I was, I had in my head a few ways I was planning on pronouncing them, but I think that you did really good with that. Congratulations.
Oh, thank you very much.
I did put a small etymological note in here. So the name Dibbler is one of several names that's used by the indigenous Noongar people of Western Australia, and they represent 14 distinct groups of people. So when you look up Dibbler, I wasn't able to find it. If anybody knows, I'd love to know. But when I looked up the etymology of the word, it didn't pinpoint which group of the Noongar people it belonged to, based on the fact that they said it came from King George Sound. The people I could find in that area were called the Noongar. I think I'm saying that right. Noongar people. So that is just an assumption. I don't actually know for sure which group this name came from, but it is an indigenous name. And I don't know what the indigenous name means either. Like, nobody translated it, if it means anything in particular, or if it's simply just the name they have for the species. Anyway, I'll let Barry get back to it. This is all you, sir.
All right, moving on to size. The average length is 14 to 15 centimeters, which equates to about 5.5 to 6 inches. The average weight is 40 to 100 grams, or 1.5 to 3.5 ounces. Sexually dimorphic, with males typically being larger than females.
I'm realizing how plain my notes are, because I usually fill in here rather than just read straight off.
So. The Dibbler is sexually dimorphic, with males typically being larger than females. Mainland Dibblers tend to be longer and heavier than island populations. For your information.
I just feel bad because there's no context. My intent is, like, when I write up these notes, is to fill in and talk and stuff. And I'm realizing that for somebody to just read my notes straight, this may look a little weird.
But this brings up a good point. There's mainland Dibblers, and then there's island populations.
Yep, that is noted in their current range too, because that's the thing that came up.
Don't worry, folks, we'll get to the current range here in just a second. But before we get to that, let's get to their appearance. So you know about their size and their average weight. Let's talk about what these things look like. They're a small shrew-like marsupial with scruffy coarse fur all over their bodies that is usually a brownish gray. The gray is due to a mixture of black and white hairs, and the white hairs give it a speckled appearance. Their underbellies are lighter with creamy white fur. They have a ring of white around their dark eyes, long whiskers, a brown nose, and round ears on top of their head, in case you wondered where ears were.
Not all animals have their ears in the same place. I feel so judged. I'm trying to be specific.
And round ears on top of their head. They also have a hairy, tapering tail. Almost, sorry, I'm still laughing at you. Feeling like I'm judging you. They also have a hairy, tapering tail almost as long as their body. So their range, we mentioned that before. Once widespread along the southwestern coastal region of Australia, there are only 2 known mainland populations and 2 populations found on islands in Jurien Bay.
Yeah, so it's going to be mentioned a little bit later on towards the end, but this was once believed to be an extinct species. They were rediscovered in actually an area of the Esperance Malay region, and then eventually they discovered more recently newer populations living on islands in Jurien Bay, as you just said. So I know my notes were a little all over the place, but... these weren't notes written for somebody else. These were notes written for me.
I'm just imagining it's like the generations of the Pokemon games, where you're used to finding this one appearance of this Pokemon, and then you go to like an island region, and suddenly you're finding the same Pokemon, but now it has like a mustache or whatever.
Like, what is it, Exeggutor? Like, the island version of Exeggutor has, like, this giraffe neck all of a sudden?
Yeah, it's like, I didn't see this coming. Okay, so moving on. Habitat. The Dibbler prefers dense vegetation. The mainland population prefers heathland?
Heathland.
Okay. It's not a word I encounter often. So the mainland population prefers heathland with vegetation at least a meter, that's about three feet tall, and 10 years unburnt. 10 years unburnt.
Yeah, because wildfires are, of course, pretty common in Australia, and so they actually prefer vegetation that has gone a long time without being burned down.
Okay. While the island populations prefer dunal scrubland and foredune heath of the sand dunes.
Yep. So heath is, so it says scrublands. Heath is common in scrublands. It's, in particular, it tends to be this this woody vegetation. So you remember living in California, the sand dunes would have the succulents and some of those arid shrubby things, plants that grew on the sand dunes.
Yeah.
So think of it like that kind of a space, those sand dunes with the very woody, herbaceous plants. That's kind of what they prefer.
And what is, there's dunal and there's foredune.
So think fore versus aft, so foredune in the front of it. And in general, and it's a little redundant. I actually took this off of the government's recovery plan for these guys, so blame them for this. So dunal scrubland in general is just saying scrubland that occurs on sand dunes, because these are very small islands for the most part, which means most of the islands are actually made of sand dunes. So it's pretty inescapable. And in particular, they like the heath that grows on. So while people might think that a sand dune is just a mound of sand, there's actually structure to sand dunes and where certain things grow on a sand dune. So there's your foredune. And if I remember correctly, the foredune faces the ocean. I'd have to look it up again. It's been a while since I've looked up sand dune anatomy. But because of the way that the wind versus ocean spray and things like that interact with the sand dune, certain plants will prefer certain parts of the dune. So obviously the heaths that grow on the foredune area of these sand dunes is preferable to other, I can't think.
If you're interested in learning about the anatomy of sand dunes, search. Moving on to diet, these little things are omnivorous, typically insectivorous, but opportunistic for other prey. Usually eats ground-dwelling invertebrates, and may also predate on small lizards, birds, mammals if available. They also eat some plants, primarily berries, from the berry saltbush, Chenopodia baccatum?
Sure.
All right. I should know. I'm a berry. Their reproduction. So during their breeding season, males will chase and attempt to mount females. Once copulation is successful, females will gestate for about 44 to 53 days before giving birth. Like all marsupials, the babies they give birth to are helpless and must remain in their mother's pouch for 3 to 4 months. Her pouch can carry up to 8 young. After leaving the pouch, young will mature for about 10 to 11 months.
Will mature by about 10 to 11 months.
Oh, I'm sorry. After leaving the pouch, young will mature by about 10 to 11 months.
Good job.
Thanks. Their lifespan. So in the wild, these little dibblers live about 1 to 2 years. The island populations tend to have a shorter lifespan. Under human care, they can live between 2 to 3 years.
Yeah, it was interesting. I was reading some of the papers that were written on these guys, and in some cases, especially with the island populations, there's still a little bit of speculation about this, but literally the males go through their breeding season for the first time and they just die. So it's almost like an octopus thing. And I found that really strange that they would just breed. But apparently it's really competitive. Resources are scarce. They invest a lot in it and they give it their all until they can't give anything more and they die. It's a rough life.
Ouch.
Yeah.
So moving on, their environmental value. They have few, if any, known native predators, but they are great insectivores. They consume beetles, cockroaches, grasshoppers, ants, termites, and spiders, even though they aren't insects. Insectivorous animals play an important role in maintaining invertebrate populations. The biomass of invertebrates often outweighs the biomass of vertebrates in many habitats. That is a lot of energy and nutrients to be stored in this group, which many birds, herps, and mammals have evolved to take advantage of. Some of the sane
Welcome to my life.
Some of the same adaptations seen in other insectivorous mammals can be seen in the dibbler, like their pointed snout, large ears, and clawed toes. The pointed or elongated snout is useful in getting into small holes and crevices where invertebrates may be hiding. The large ears have a keener sense of hearing for detecting the movements of invertebrates, sometimes even underground. The clawed toes are for digging and uncovering invertebrates. The digging that dibblers do to find insects also plays a role in turning over and aerating the soil, which impacts the health and biodiversity of the underground organisms. So dibblers can help keep insect populations in check and maintain local soil health.
I see that you're getting a small taste for the absolute struggle that every podcaster has. So did you have any questions about my notes that you're reading out loud? Because normally this is a back and forth, but you're just straight up reading it now.
If you were me, what would you have said by now? Wait, if you were me, what would I have said by now?
are you asking what would I have asked if I was in your situation, or if as a host, what would I have added to this?
No, if I was the host and you were my guest and you didn't know anything about this and I wrote this up, what would you have thought that I would have thought to have said to you to ask about the dibbler?
Oh, goodness. That's difficult because I literally read, like, several scientific papers and recovery plans and stuff on these animals. So it's hard for me to ask questions because I actually do know a lot of the answers.
Do you know how small the little, I guess they're joeys? Since these are marsupials.
Yep, they would be called joeys.
They can keep up to 8 young in their pouch. So either they've got a really big pouch or these are really small babies.
They are very small. I mean, a lot of these things come out, they border on being like just these super tiny, what's the word I'm looking for? Well, like embryos. They're just ridiculously small. I can't recall if I read specifically the size of the joeys anywhere. Let me back up to reproduction.
Oh, and here's some information. Can you scroll back up for a second? In case you were wondering about the sexual reproduction itself.
Oh, God.
Successful mountings involve the male clasping the female in a neck grip, and a single copulation may continue for hours.
I don't try to make my podcast sexy.
I don't think I made that sound sexy.
Oh, goodness. Yeah, I don't think there's a lot of information about the size of joeys, which is interesting because there's been a lot of breeding in human care. So you would think that there would be some description of the joeys, but there actually isn't. I'm sure the information exists. It's just somebody didn't bother writing it down.
Well, considering that the size of a full-grown dibbler is, what did we say?
The length or the weight?
The length.
So they're about 5.5 to 6 inches as adults.
So they're like half a foot at most.
Yeah.
So, these babies have to be like an inch, maybe the...
Maybe less. Well, I mean, you got to remember, though, marsupials are intense. Do you remember the one time we've been to zoos and seen like kangaroos with like their joeys' legs hanging out and stuff, and the joeys were just like not fitting in their mom's pouch anymore, but still like crawling into it?
Yeah.
Marsupial babies don't care about mom's comfort.
But that was one joey, not 8 trying to crawl into mom's pouch.
Yeah, if you think that That's a lot. You should see Virginia possums with like their dozen or so babies just hanging out their pouches, man.
All right, continuing on. You want me to continue on?
Yeah, go for it.
All right, continuing on with social value. Little is known about the dibbler outside of Australia, and even within Australia, it's not well known outside of Western Australia. The Perth Zoo participates in the Western Australian Department of Parks and Wildlife's Native Species Breeding Program to maintain a breeding colony of dibblers that are raised to be released back into native parts of their range that have been...
I'm sorry, this is a very long sentence.
Let me try that again.
Okay.
The Perth Zoo participates in the Western Australian Department of Parks and Wildlife's Native Species Breeding Program to maintain a breeding colony of diddlers.
Diddlers! Oh man, this is gonna kill me.
All right.
One more time.
The Perth Zoo participates in the Western Australian Department of Parks and Wildlife's The Perth Zoo participates in the Western Australian Department of Parks and Wildlife's Native Species Breeding Program to maintain a breeding colony of dibblers that are raised to be released back into native parts of their range that have been managed to remove invasive predators. Over 900 dibblers have been released back into their native habitat through this program. The zoo also does education for the public about this endangered species to raise awareness and support for its conservation.
Yep, so that's actually sort of how I found dibblers. Was by accident. I was looking at endangered mammals of Western Australia, and a lot of ones that come up are quolls and numbats and bandicoots and things like that. And I was like, okay, cool. I've heard of these things. I know they're really interesting, but I was really hoping to find, and I know you know this, I was potentially looking at the bandicoot because while people are familiar with the name, they may not necessarily always be familiar with the species. But then I saw dibbler. There was no way I wasn't.
Dibs.
I called dibs. There was no way I wasn't talking about an animal called a freaking dibbler.
So remind me, what was the animal from? What was the last animal?
The bandicoot.
No, no, not the last one you mentioned. Last one you covered.
Last one I covered on my podcast series.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Last animal I talked about was the Pacific sand dab with you.
So you have dabbed, and now you're dibbing. Dibbing and dabbing. Dabbing and dibbing.
Why would you do this to a sick person?
Also, we mentioned quolls. They have nothing to do with koalas, which is the first thing I asked. And
sincerely, too.
Sincerely.
I was joking. You thought I was calling a koala bear a quoll for
yeah,
sure.
Yeah, I thought that this was just like keeper slang, and that's just what keepers called them.
Keeper slang.
Keeper slang.
There's a lot of that in the world.
Yeah. So I figured this was more of that. But no, quolls have nothing to do with koalas. They're not related at all.
Not of that quality. I wish people could see the glare you just gave me. But yeah, it's really cool. The Perth Zoo has done some really great work with the dibbler conservation program that they've been running. And I am super excited to share all the pictures that I found from the Perth Zoo of dibblers. They're really adorable. I cried a little bit looking at some of their pictures.
Aww.
They're precious. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, it's all right. Everyone take a moment to cry. Okay, moving on to economic value.
Oh.
We're not moving on.
I just realized I didn't even finish the sentence in my notes.
You want me to just make up the ending?
Well, we'll see how this goes. If a sentence doesn't make sense, just pause. I might fill in.
Okay. Moving on to economic value. In addition to the value they have at zoological facilities, these insectivorous animals are beneficial for agriculture. With native wildlife in decline and some on the verge of extinction in Australia due to invasive species and human development, many of the animals that once regulated the populations of lesser trophic species have not been able to fulfill their ecological
You need to slow down. You just like flew through that.
I was on a roll.
I know, but you don't have to read super fast. Just, oh man, I can actually breathe. Just enunciate, speak well. Don't focus on like marathoning through it.
Moving on to economic value. In addition to the value that they have at zoological facilities, these insectivorous animals are beneficial for agriculture. With native wildlife in decline and some on the verge of extinction in Australia due to invasive species and human development, many of the animals that once regulated the populations of lesser trophic species have not been able to fulfill their ecological roles. About half the land of the Esperance Mallee region has been cleared for development and agriculture, with hundreds of farms dotting the land. Pest control, especially when it comes to insects, can be difficult and an expensive problem for farmers to treat. Animals that eat invertebrate animals that eat invertebrate.
You want a drink of water?
No, I just took one.
Okay.
Animals that eat invertebrate.
I'm so having an outtake at the end of this.
Invertebrate.
Are you turning British people inside out?
Animals that eat invertebrate pests can be a boon for farmlands in managing pest species. The use of broad-spectrum pesticides are chemicals that kill invertebrates rather indiscriminately, both harmful pests and beneficial native species, and contain neurotoxins that can affect people as well.
I'm sorry.
I know, this is made for you, not...
Well, not just that. COVID brain isn't a great brain, and also, my notes have holes in them a bit. So basically, insectivorous animals are really important, and in scrubland especially, that's mostly what lives there. Like, whenever you look at these arid regions, it's very often inhabited by a lot of invertebrates and a lot of things that eat invertebrates. And so the issue is, especially in Australia, a lot of invasive species were introduced before a lot of development started. And so when they started developing these farmlands and they have issues with these pests, they're so accustomed to the land without the animals keeping the habitat and balance that they're stuck treating all these pest issues without realizing that if they had never lost some of the native species in the first place, they might not have as severe an issue with pests and other things as they currently do. So this region is literally half farmland. Half of it's still relatively preserved, half of it's farmland, and then there's like a little bit of, you know, towns and cities sprinkled here and there in between. But the point I was trying to make in all of this was just that insectivorous animals are important. A lot of insectivorous animals have been lost in these habitats. Many of the species that are in decline, or like this one that have been thought to be extinct before, could be helping with some of these issues, helping to alleviate some of the pressure put on the farmlands by invertebrates if we protect them.
Like that, instead of using broad-spectrum pesticides, which are chemicals that kill invertebrates.
So here's the problem. One of the reasons why the broad-spectrum pesticides being used is also introduced insects. So that's another completely separate issue. So things like ladybird beetles. Certain species have been introduced that can be very harmful to the crops. Those, I don't know if animals like the dibbler would be able to help with some of these invasive species, but at the very least, for some of the native species that are considered pest species, they would be able to potentially help with that, because they do eat things like cockroaches, which are considered a pest. Ladybird beetles are beetles, and beetles are something that they eat. So I don't know the full extent to which they would be able to help. I don't feel like they would be able to fully like supplant the use of pesticides. But the problem is because they use broad-spectrum pesticides rather than pesticides that target a specific group of animals, the broad-spectrum pesticides tend to be very harmful. In fact, they're banned in the EU, and they're banned in certain states in the US, and they are heavily regulated in the US because of the neurotoxins in them. So less is better. None is best. but to help people get away from the use of these problematic pesticides, it might be beneficial to help recover a lot more of their insectivorous animals that have been in decline, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
Yeah, because the native species aren't going to be able to fully get rid of all their pest problems, but at the very least, they might alleviate it.
I just didn't know if you wanted me to reread that last sentence.
Don't worry about my messy notes. I mean, I didn't even finish. I mean, look at that. I didn't even finish the conservation part.
We'll just add some stuff in.
Yeah, we'll talk about it a bit.
Conservation! The dibbler is a Lazarus species, meaning that it was once believed to have been extinct by science until it was rediscovered. While they face many threats, the largest issue that caused their population declines was the introduction of other species. They compete with introduced house mice and are eaten by invasive red foxes and domesticated cats.
Fun fact, they found out that they were being eaten by domesticated or by red foxes because they found a tracking collar in red fox poop. That had to hurt.
A tracking collar that was put on a dibbler?
Yeah. They put a tracking collar on a dibbler, fox ate the dibbler, pooped out the collar.
Mm-hmm. Were there any other collars in there? Like of cats?
I don't know. I don't know if red foxes hunt domesticated cats at all. Because the problem is actually in Australia, the two tend to be a big issue. Like, in almost all places where a native mammal or bird has gone extinct or declined severely in Australia and New Zealand, most often red foxes, domesticated cats, and introduced mice or rats were the issue. Like, those are the apocalyptic horsemen of Australia, is these species. They've come in and decimated so many species of animals across Australia because Australia doesn't have a lot of big predators. Like, arguably, there's a lot of debate about dingoes and where they came from, whether or not they're even native. The Tasmanian tiger, of course, is long extinct thanks to humans. Almost all of the large mammals in Australia are basically kangaroos and humans. Those are the two big mammals. Everything else is mostly small mammals, birds, lots of venomous snakes and lizards and stuff, you know. And they're all threatened by these animals. Like we mentioned in the reintroduction part with the Perth Zoo, they are specifically reintroducing them to areas where predators are being managed. So they do have programs where they've been trapping things like the house mice, the red foxes, and feral cats and removing them from the spaces where these animals are being reintroduced to make sure that they're no longer competing with these invasive species. So that's one of the ways that they're trying to improve their chances of reintroduction, is removing the thing that threatened them in the first place.
Got it. So this is something that I haven't asked you before. And, I mean, I could do a Google search and find this out. But since we're already being recorded, now seems like the perfect time to ask.
Let's record our ignorance.
Yes. I have no shame. Where does the term Lazarus species come from?
If I remember correctly, it's biblical.
Well, yes. I just don't remember who Lazarus was, or if
Well, wasn't that the point? Is he came back from the dead?
Oh my God! They buried him, and he had like one of those like little bells in his coffin that he like rings, and he's like, "I'm not dead."
Yeah, no. The whole point of the whole point of a Lazarus species is that it has to be an animal that is considered extinct or gone, and is later discovered to not be. Now, there is a bit of an issue with the term Lazarus in some ways because science can apply it a little liberally in cases where a species isn't known to be extinct by the indigenous people, just science. And that's kind of been an issue, is science often neglects what is known by local or indigenous people sometimes. And very often in cases of species thought to be extinct, indigenous people will sometimes be like, hey, we knew this was here, and sometimes it's even the indigenous people who let us know that they're still there, especially for terrestrial species. And so the problem is we'll see these articles that go, oh, this species has been rediscovered by science. And it's like, well, this is kind of ridiculous because indigenous people have been telling us that these species have still been around for years and nobody listened. And now science is claiming that they've rediscovered the species, and it's basically ignoring indigenous contributions to biology. So I sometimes try to be careful with the term Lazarus. Now, I couldn't find any evidence that indigenous communities contradicted that the Dibbler was extinct, but I won't discount that there was potential for indigenous communities to have known that the Dibblers weren't extinct while science didn't realize that they weren't. So it's a thing. Are you done Googling Lazarus?
Yep.
What'd you find?
What I saw was that Lazarus was a biblical individual who passed away. Jesus was very sad at his passing and seems to have brought him back to life after a few days.
Anyway, so the point is, the Dibbler was once thought to be extinct. The major reason behind its extinction was invasive species. Invasive species management has done a lot to allow Dibblers to be reintroduced back into their native environment. And they are slowly making a comeback, and the Western Australian government is definitely taking great strides to help reintroduce it and protect spaces for it to thrive in. So, good on them.
Guess who's back? Back again.
Stop. Nope.
Dibbler's back. Tell a friend.
Stop. Please. Just read the outro, man.
And that's a wrap for this episode about the Dibbler. Thank you so much for listening. For this episode, we cited some information from the Government of Western Australia Department of Conservation and Land Management's Dibbler Recovery Plan, the Perth Zoo, and Animal Diversity Web. If you have any questions or comments, feel free to reach out to her email at thenaturalist@thenaggingnaturalist.com and check out her website at thenaggingnaturalist.com. On social media, you can find The Nagging Naturalist on Facebook and Instagram, as well as on Twitter, @nag_naturalist. You can leave her reviews on Apple Podcasts and podchaser.com to help support this podcast. If you love learning about wildlife and don't want to wait for another episode, check out some of these other wildlife podcasts. All Creatures, Crittercast, The Wildlife, Just the Zoo of Us, Animals to the Max, Varmints, Amazing Wildlife Podcast, The Casual Birder, What Are You Podcast, The Songbirding Podcast, The Cicada Lounge, Life, Death, and Taxonomy, and Strange Animals Podcast, which are all safe for work. And Keeper Chat is a great podcast too, though it's definitely not safe for work. Also, here are some really great podcasts you can check out that discuss other sciences, or science in general. Petri Dish, Planthropology, Bald Scientist, Dear Grad Student, Better Than Human, More Than Just a Scientist, Curiosity Cake, Mad Scientist, What Are You Going to Do With That?, Papa PhD, Breaking Math, Curiosity Killed the Rat, That's What I Call Science, and Scientist, with two T's at the end of scientist. Some of these podcasts are and aren't safe for work, so be sure to double check if that's a concern. She is also on a non-wildlife podcast called Legend of Portalcast, which discusses the world of Avatar the Last Airbender and the Legend of Korra. She'll be back next week with another species from the Esperance Mallee Shrubland. I've been Barry. You've been great. Good night.
You did a great job, sweetie.
I would like to add as a little bit of a caveat here at the end. I am not sure how my health is going to be for the next few weeks. I am hopeful that this is not going to last much longer. My symptoms do feel kind of reduced today, and so I am hoping this is a good sign and that I'm going to be doing a little bit better and feeling a little bit better in the near future, but it's hard to say. So I hopefully will be able to do 4 whole species this month. There is, of course, the possibility that my health might take a turn, and I might not be able to do all four episodes this month, so I do apologize in advance if there's any inconsistency in my scheduling. I am going to try my best to do all four species for this month like I did last month, but if I don't, I am sorry, and I will try to make up for the content elsewhere. For those of you who know, I am extremely active on my Twitter. If you hop on Twitter, I do things like a weekly Whose Butt Is It Anyway, where I post an animal butt picture and people try to identify the butt. It's a lot of fun. I enjoy doing it. It's cool seeing people trying to guess. Sometimes it's really easy, sometimes it's really tricky, but that's usually where you're going to find a lot of the activity that I do is on my Twitter account. So if I struggle to get episodes up and not a lot of content is going up, I would definitely recommend checking out my Twitter account and looking at some of the extra content that I post up over there. So, yeah. Hopefully y'all enjoyed this. I know it was a huge departure from the normal, but if anybody's familiar with COVID, it can cause breathing problems and other things. And so I was finding when I was starting to record that talking for more than a few minutes at a time is a little costly. So Barry thankfully stepped in to help me make this episode possible. So we'll see what happens next week. But I hope everybody's doing well. For those of you who have experienced COVID or are currently going through COVID, I strongly sympathize with you now. For those of you who have never had COVID and have only heard about other people's experiences, even as somebody who has what are qualifying as mild symptoms, this is really bad. This has been an extremely difficult week for me. I've been mostly bedridden, and I missed all of the wonderful snow that we had, which was extremely distressing for me as somebody who likes to play in the snow. So wear your mask, stay 6 feet away, and just be very conscientious. Sometimes, no matter how careful you try to be, just everything outside of the home is a risk. And it may not seem like it's a big risk, but I can tell you this is not the cold. This is not the flu. This is awful. So take care of yourselves. And we'll see you next week.